Project Access for All, the podcast. Interviews and stories about issues, organizations, and people working to create access and inclusion for people with disabilities. Everyone should be welcome everywhere. Here's Project Access host, Alvaro Gutierrez.
Hello and welcome to Project Access for All. Today our guest is Marca Bristow. She's the president and CEO of the Access Living of Metropolitan Chicago. Thank you so much, Marca, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's my pleasure, Marca, and we would like to know, as the beginning, a little bit about your life.
Sure. Well, I grew up in upstate New York on a farm. I didn't really know much about disability. I did not have a disability. In hindsight, I realized my mom had a disability. She had cancer twice when I was little and lived her life with very significant respiratory challenges. Moving from the farm to some other small towns in upstate New York, we ended up settling in a little village called West Winfield. And after I left my hometown, I spent a year in the Philippines as an exchange student, which really opened up my eyes about the role of America at the global level, and I think impacted some of my international interests, which was sparked many, many years later. I ended up going to college in Beloit, Wisconsin, and came down to Chicago to become a nurse midwife. And I was out with some friends one night, and my friend's dog knocked my shoes into Lake Michigan, and I wanted my shoes back. So I dived into Lake Michigan to retrieve them, and didn't realize that it was very, very shallow because we were on a very long pier. And I broke my neck at the C7-8 level, and that began my journey into the world of disability and eventually into the world of disability rights.
And today, what are you doing?
Wow. Today, I run an organization in Chicago called Access Living. We were modeled after the first Center for Independent Living, CIL, in Berkeley. I've been at the helm of Access Living since its founding. It stemmed out of people at the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago looking into what they should do because so many young people that they were discharging from their rehab hospital were ending up in nursing homes. And this was shortly after my accident. They invited me to come to these committee meetings, and eventually I went and didn't think their plan of developing a transitional living center made sense. And that was one of my first transformational moments, because they actually listened to me. They said, why would I not want to live there? And I explained that my problem was not that I needed a place to, learn how to mop the floor and make the bed. It really became more of an issue that the home I had at the time I broke my neck had 7 steps. And my real need was not for practicing how to live with a disability, it was to find an accessible home. And to the credit of the Rehab Institute, the people who were working on this idea listened to myself and some other disabled people that were in this meeting, and folded up their plans and decided to start again. And when they did so, they tripped upon this great organization in Berkeley and decided that Access Living would be modeled after that. And we became one of the first 10 federally funded centers for independent living. For your listeners who don't know what a CIL is, you can get more information at ncil.org. The National Council on Independent Living is a membership association of all of us. There's now in excess of 500 such organizations scattered all around the country. And what makes us different from other organizations is that we are really walk the walk and talk the talk about disability inclusion and empowerment. So a majority of our board, a majority of our staff, a majority of our management are people with disabilities. We work with people with a wide array of different disabilities, and we do a mix of services to help people become more independent living, as well as advocacy, using a peer-based approach. So our goal is to not only assist people through service delivery, but to get those people more engaged in the advocacy agenda of our organizations. And as a result of this model, we became, to some extent, the national infrastructure back when the Americans with Disabilities Act was being organized. So we had boots on the ground, so to speak, or wheels on the ground. And when the National Council on Disability called upon Congress to pass a comprehensive civil rights law, the network of Centers for Independent Living became a very important part of the grassroots apparatus that worked with the people in Washington, both to give feedback on the new law as it evolved, but also to mobilize local constituents to weigh in with their congressmen. And as a result of that, we passed the most comprehensive civil rights law in 1990, since the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Very interesting all you say, Mark, and for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about those services you provide?
Sure. Well, each center takes its direction from the local community. So while we all have a very similar philosophy, and we all provide five core services, we do them in slightly different ways, and many of us have additional services beyond those core. The core services are information and referral, peer support, independent living skill training, and now advocacy. And just last year, the law was amended to add a fifth core service called transition. And the transition services that centers will now be providing will both be transition to help people get out of institutions, as well as transition for teenagers who are making the move from high school to college or high school to work. That's a new service. Many of us have already been doing a lot of that work, but this will now make it an obligatory service that centers all around the country will be providing.
Mark, if I may, you were talking about transition. How was, for you personally, the transition when you acquired the disability after your accident? And can
sure.
you give any advice to people?
Mm-hmm. Well, remember that I was already finished with college. I had already gotten my nursing degree, and I was working as a labor and delivery nurse. So the very first thing that happened, it was pretty shocking to the system, actually, because I lost my job, I lost my home, I lost my health insurance, I lost my income, I lost my transportation, I lost some of my friends. But fortunately for me, my family and my friends really rallied around me. And that was hard. I have to be honest with you. It was really hard. And for me, my way of dealing with it, rather than to get depressed, was to get a little angry. And that anger, I do believe that when we feel injustice, it often manifests as anger. And if you can turn that emotion into righting those wrongs, it's not only a way to help you deal with the anger, but also to use it for a force of good. But I can tell you, Anna, what ended up happening for me was a woman who I never even met, who was the head of nursing at a very prestigious woman's hospital in Chicago, called me up and she'd read an article about me and asked me if I'd like to come back to work. And it had only been about maybe 6 months since my accident. And it still shocks me to know that my answer to her question was, I can't work. And what I meant was, honestly, I can't work as a nurse, even though I certainly could. And I just bring that up to say how quick we internalize the messages that the rest of the world places on us. And lucky for me, she asked me to come in anyway and talk with her. So she did what the ADA later would have us do, because this was all in 1978. She did job sharing. She took three jobs apart and put them together differently so I could do the sedentary tasks and other nurses could do the more ambulatory tasks. Once I went back to work, my world opened up quite a bit. I learned how to drive a car because I never had, because there was no accessible transit. But I have to tell you, the experience of living in my city in Chicago in 1978, and I think Chicago was ahead of its time compared to other cities. We already had a few curb cuts down in the city center, not very many, but it was like going into a third world country. All the things you couldn't do simply because you were using a wheelchair for mobility were really dramatic. There was only one movie theater in town that I could go to. Most restaurants, it had no accessible bathrooms, so you kind of had to time how long you were out. I took more kitchen entrances into restaurants and hotels than I care to remember. Rode on freight elevators to get into world-class museums, one time with a rat. So it was pretty disheartening. I guess the other thing I would say is, I was only 23 when this happened, so I was still, dating and out in the social world, and I was lucky that I had a lot of friends that, still invited me to do everything with them. But I can tell you that the men that I would interact with, there was a day and night difference. The same men that used to flirt with me now kind of looked right through me as if I wasn't even there. So there was a lot to adjust to, but fortunately for me, my boss sent me out to California to a conference, and I met a lot of people with disabilities. I saw how they had curb cuts everywhere. People were out and about in the community who use wheelchairs and who were deaf and blind. And I remember staying up all night with this disabled woman, and asking her, how come everything's so different here? And she told me about these activists that had first taken on making the UC Berkeley campus accessible, but then later went out into the community and advocated for change. And so that gave me my voice back. It gave me my power back. It made me realize that those curbs that prevented me from going around the corner could be eliminated with a simple, hammer to break them up a little. And what we needed was some reform in our laws and our policies to improve things.
Wow, that has been powerful, Marca. You have me thinking a lot of things now. Okay, let me put my mind together now, because I have a few more questions related to this. I think for our listeners it's interesting. First, do you think, and this is something that I haven't seen anywhere, but you have you have talked about it, so I'm interested in this. You were saying that because of the accident, as a nurse, you were able to do certain things you were not able to do, but the person that brought you into the organization was able to adapt the job to this situation.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, do you think most jobs we can do as people with disabilities, if they were a little bit changed in certain degrees, is that understood by the organization? Is that done a lot? Because I never read about that before.
Yeah, it's called job sharing, where they'll, you know, take tasks from one job and, you know, reassign tasks. I do think that people with disabilities, if you take us as a group, in other words, people who are deaf, blind, wheelchair users, et cetera, et cetera, there's going to be people with disabilities that can do almost any of those jobs. Not every person will be able to do all of them.
Right.
But there's some things, for example, that a blind person could do that a wheelchair user might not be able to do, and vice versa. So I think the common element, of course, is the bias that people have about our ability to do things. And that, even though the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits discrimination, and it's a very important legal tool, it's really hard to, and probably not possible, to legislate people's hearts, you know, what they think, how they feel.
Yes.
So, you know, what I believe we have to be doing more of is helping to educate people on positive examples of people who are already doing a lot of the work that they may think you're not able to do. And using the law, of course, when those rights are violated. But I definitely think that there are many jobs that people with disabilities are very capable of doing. They're just often not given the chance. And interesting that in those examples that we know of where people have made the adjustments or provided reasonable accommodations to people so that they could work, tremendous things happen. They are often sitting side by side with non-disabled people, many of whom have never had a chance to get to know somebody on a personal level. And, you know, that's what really begins to break down stigma when you're, you know, becoming friends with, co-workers with. There's nothing better to help open people's eyes than that process of getting to know people, because it provides both dialogue and it helps break down some of the myths that so often separate us.
How interesting, Marca. I need to mention for listeners, I know of a surgeon who is a wheelchair user here in Colombia. He was shot twice.
Mm-hmm.
And after the situation happened, he asked at the hospital, "I would like to still be a surgeon, but I need some adaptation of materials in the surgery room, etc." And they were able to do that, and he's a very well-known surgeon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's many examples. In fact, I want to make sure that I erase the stereotype that I may have left with my own comment that I couldn't do that nursing. There is an organization called the National Organization of Nurses with Disabilities, and there are enormous opportunities in the field of nursing for people with varying disabilities. And nurses will tell you many of them stay in the workforce long enough that they age into their disabilities. So there's numerous examples of people who have been working for a long time and they've managed to be accommodated in the workplace. However, what we still see are barriers in licensure or barriers sometimes in the academic preparation, where they'll say that to become licensed to be a nurse, you have to be able to perform a certain number of tasks. even though no nurse provides all of those tasks, and there are subspecialties that a nurse could go into without having, for example, to be able to make a bed or lift a patient. So I think that we have still a long ways to go to break down some of those systemic barriers. And that's why organizations come together. There's an association of law students with disabilities. There's an association of lawyers who are deaf. And, you know, increasingly, as we see more and more people in the workplace, I think we'll begin to see some of these remnants that still create barriers or discrimination against people with disabilities. We'll begin to see them come apart.
Mark, another question comes to mind. What would you recommend to someone with disabilities who wants to become anything, whether it's a doctor or a lawyer, but they don't know where to begin precisely for what you are saying? They say, I am not able to do 100% of the tasks. How am I going to be able to show them I have the passion and the capacity to do many of those tasks?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the first thing I want to say is you got to start young, right? Way back when in America, in the educational system, our young people with disabilities have individual education plans or 504 plans. These are very important tools that students should become more involved with themselves at the earliest age possible to make sure that their rights are being followed and that their service plans are being implemented the way they want them implemented. All too often, kids are either shuttled into a career direction based upon those low expectations without the young person ever even expressing what they want to do. Secondly, I think it's really important that families support their young people. Connect with other adults with disabilities so you can see what's possible. The Centers for Independent Living are a great opportunity to do that. I think when a parent is able to see the potential of their kid and see beyond the limitations that the world often places on them, that parent can become a really important ally in breaking barriers down and in helping the young person develop the sense of self-esteem, self-confidence, and what we would call a rights-bearing attitude. So all of those things are really important. And then when it gets to the time where other kids are starting to think about college or what they're going to do afterwards, I think it's really important that young people with disabilities push to get all those after-school activities to build up their resume, so to speak. You know, to do a student internship, to volunteer, to get a job for the summer. That's how people without disabilities do it. And all too often, our young people haven't been given those same opportunities. We have to insist upon them. Then, I think it's pursue your dream. Decide what it is you want to do. Thoroughly research it. See if you can find some other people with disabilities who are doing it so that you can ask them, how did they manage it? So, for example, the doctor that you mentioned, there are quite a few doctors now in the U.S. with disabilities. So helping connect people to successful role models, I think, is really important.
Now, another question in this case for our listeners, maybe a complicated one, but I think it's important, and you talk about it almost in the beginning. When that person that offered you the opportunity to work again as a nurse called you and you said, no, I'm not able to work, I want to talk that subject, because some people with disabilities, because of the emotional situation they are facing after acquiring the disability mentally feel that they are less able than they are. And it happens to many people. Even people I know, Marca, I talk to, and I say, are you working? And they say, nah, I am blind, I'm not able to work. And I say, well, that is not correct. You are able to work.
Yes.
So my more than a question, Marca, is I want your opinion. How can we push ourselves to be able to get out of the house and say, look, I may have a disability, but I'm more able than I even believe. I need to prove
it's that. A really important question. Really important. If you read particularly feminism literature, there's something called internalization of oppression. It's when you take all the stereotypes that society has towards a particular group and you internalize them yourself so that you are essentially discriminating against yourself. You are denying yourself the opportunities because you're buying the stereotypes that the society at large has placed on you. The only way I know to challenge that is to get out in the world and try to learn what your rights are, number one. And it's, you know, you may fail, but everybody, that's how people get strong, right? Trial and error. All too often, we're not even given the dignity of risk. You know, we're overprotected from trying things. So I think we got to call it like it is. And when somebody says that, I think it's really important to try, if at all possible, to have a mentor also with a disability who can push them and say, no, it doesn't have to be a disabled person. In my case, when that supervisor said, why don't you come on in, it was her encouragement that got me over it, right? It didn't take a lobbying effort. It just took her believing in me. The other thing I will say is we have a whole system of disincentives for disabled people built into our public policies. So in America, for example, if you go on Social Security Disability or SSI, there's limitations on your ability to work. And a lot of people are rightfully afraid, well, what if I try to work and I'm not successful at it? Then I'll lose my benefits or I'll lose my health insurance. We've begun to whittle away at some of those policies to develop trial work periods or to make it just a little easier for people to get back on if they've tried and it hasn't worked. And now, of course, with the Affordable Care Act, people are not as dependent upon Medicare and Medicaid as we used to be when we were blatantly discriminated against by insurance companies. So now people don't have that obstacle. You know, if they lose their health benefits by being on SSI or SSDI and get a job, either the employer will provide it or they can get it on the exchange. So little by little, I think we're beginning to take apart those barriers, but there's still a lot of work to do.
You were talking about the importance of advocacy. Can you tell us about it?
Well, you know, in America, we have a long tradition of civil disobedience, civil rights, protest, activism, and I know many of us hang on to former leaders' quotes, and the one that resonates for me in this context is Frederick Douglass, who said, power concedes nothing without demand. It never has and it never will. So I feel like if you're not happy with your life because of something external to you, that should be a good impetus to get involved. And when you do get involved, something, it changes you. Instead of feeling inferior or like you can't. When you get involved with advocacy with others, number one, the camaraderie, the being part of something much greater than yourself. And then when you have a victory, you begin to feel your power. And disabled people have felt powerless for most of our, you know, most of humanity. And it's really tremendous when you see something that you helped change, it lifts you. And it makes you want to do more. It also takes you outside of yourself. So, you know, the self-pity and the way in which some people get trapped by depression or self-pity, this kind of action, it's service, right? And service to others takes us outside of ourselves and I think lifts us up in a spiritual way.
I don't have this as a question, but I need to ask. Do you do any motivational speaking?
Not really. I do public speaking. It's usually more on topics, like right now, for example, because we're at the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Myself and friends like me all over the country are being asked to speak to people about that, or when we were working on health reform, I might get invited to speak about that, but
you could do.
I'm not so big on the motivational speaker thing because so much of the time it separates, you know, people. It makes people think they're so much different because, many of us just hate being considered a quote unquote inspirational.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, many of us are just doing, you know, getting up in the morning and going to work. That should not be inspirational, just because we do that. You know what I mean?
I do agree with you, but I think the way you see life and the experiences that you have had and the people you have met may be a good example for others to understand what is possible. That's all I'm saying. But I understand also your view. I know time is running out, but I have two more questions. One is, what is the most rewarding part of the work you do every day?
Okay. I think I have two answers. One is watching people's lives change. You know, the folks who come here, in particular the folks who we're helping to get out of nursing homes, and they come here at first and they're so kind of downtrodden, you know, they don't have a lot of self-confidence. And then fast forward, you know, after they've gone on the journey, gotten out, are living on their own, and now they're showing up for other stuff, getting involved, and just seeing the change in their spirit, that's very rewarding. And then the other thing is, I guess I would say, watching and helping other leaders grow. You know, seeing, I think those would be the two things.
Marka, you have been mentioning the ADA, and my question to you is, the ADA can do what it can do, and is great, and it's a living document, and it's going to be evolving and everything, but who has the responsibility to make this society full inclusive? Because organizations, I think they are waking up and they are starting to do a lot of things. Some because of the pressure of things like the ADA, some because of the good conscience and good hearts. But should people with disabilities also do more than we are doing right now? What would you say?
Well, your question, who has the responsibility? For me, the answer is simple. Everybody.
Mm-hmm.
This is not our issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm tired of people making it our issue. It's our society's issue. And, of course, that includes us. We, as disabled people, have a responsibility to push for its implementation, to learn how the law protects my rights, to become an agent for change ourselves. But that's only a small part of it. The rest of society has an enormous responsibility, and it shouldn't take a lawsuit to cause change. And I do believe that as science and technology are allowing babies to be born earlier and more frail than ever before, many of whom go on to have lifelong disabilities, and people are now living not only into their 80s, but their 90s and the hundreds now, and they too are acquiring disabilities, that the numbers of us, the sheer demographic shift will demand change. So I feel that our communities as a whole, agencies of local government, boards, commissions, foundations, businesses, other nonprofit organizations, lawyers, doctors, I mean, there isn't anybody that I can think of that doesn't have a responsibility to take a look at what they're doing in their own wheelhouse. How do they relate to people with disabilities? Do they put up barriers that they don't mean to? What can they do to make things more inclusive and open and welcoming?
And your message for people with disabilities listening, how can we make sure the ADA 25 is only the beginning of celebrating and making sure that we are progressing in our inclusion in society?
Learn your rights. Get involved. If there's an area that the law isn't clearly covering, write a new law so that it does. So there's, you know, there's always new work to be done, and I surmise that this next generation is going to have a whole new litany of tasks that they're going to need to focus on. Many in the technological universe, you know, we've got a few laws that protect our rights in the technology space, but there's still a lot of gaps. So as more and more and more and more commerce and social life are dependent upon digital and other technological advances, we have to ask, are we going to be left behind again? And I think the answer to that is maybe, but it's not too late for the next generation and those of us who've been around a while to discern what needs to change to prevent that from happening. Thank you very much, Alvaro, for inviting me. I really appreciate it, and best of luck to you and to all your listeners. I hope whoever's listening will feel compelled to look in their own wheelhouse and do something different that will create a more inclusive environment for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marca.
And goodbye.
Goodbye. And for our listeners, remember you can follow us on Twitter, you can like us on Facebook, and you can visit our website at www.projectaccessforall, and you can email us to be on the show at podcast@projectaccessforall.org. So from Alvaro, from ABS, and Project Access for All, thank you so much for listening to the show, and have a wonderful day.
Project Access for All, the podcast, is a production of Art Beyond Sight in New York. For more about Art Beyond Sight and Project Access, visit this website, projectaccessforall.org. And you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and find Project Access on iTunes. Project Access. Everyone should be welcome, everywhere.